This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden has taken another step aimed at lowering gas prices amid criticism. The move is to boost Democrats' chances in next month's elections. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Nearly a year's worth of extraordinary efforts have yet to make a big dent at the pumps. And while prices are falling, the president says they're not falling fast enough, and families are still hurting.
You've heard me say it before, but I get it.
And he wants frustrated voters to get that he's still trying. The latest move is releasing another 15 million barrels of oil from the nation's strategic reserve, with perhaps more to come in the winter. The president's political fortunes do appear tied to gas prices. Still, he's bristling at critics who suggest this step is politically motivated.
Where have they been the last 4 months?
Saying he authorized SPR drawdowns months ago. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has declared martial law in four of Ukraine's regions, parts of which are under the control of Russian troops, as Ukrainian forces continue to liberate occupied territories in the country's east. Putin said in an online session of the Russian Security Council on Wednesday that he signed a decree declaring martial law in Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia regions, all of which Russia illegally annexed last month. Putin didn't immediately describe the steps that would be taken under martial law, but said his order was effective starting at midnight on Thursday. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. Also on the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. The World Health Organization said Wednesday it is too early to lift the highest level alert for the COVID-19 crisis, with the pandemic remaining a global health emergency despite recent progress. The WHO's Emergency Committee on COVID-19 met last week and concluded that the pandemic still constitutes a public health emergency of international concern, a status it declared back in January of 2020. WHO Chief Tedros Ghebreyesus told reporters Wednesday that he agreed with the committee's advice. He said the committee emphasized the need to strengthen surveillance and expand access to tests, treatments, and vaccines for those most at risk. Embattled British leader Liz Truss told lawmakers she's not a quitter. We get more on the story. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
In the first Prime Minister's questions since new Chancellor Jeremy Hunt performed U-turns on almost all of the tax cuts announced 3 weeks ago, Truss had fiery exchanges with opposition leader Keir Starmer, who listed the full range of policy terms.
To her supposed best friend, the former Chancellor, he's gone as well. They're all gone. So why is she still here?
Not a Truss has apologised to Parliament and admitted she's made mistakes so far during her short tenure as Britain's head of government. Charles de Ledesma, London.
A judge says former U.S. President Donald Trump knew his voter fraud claims were false. AP correspondent Lisa Dwyer reports.
A federal judge says that former President Donald Trump signed legal documents after the 2020 election that included voter fraud claims he knew were inaccurate. U.S. District Court Judge David Carter wrote in an 18-page opinion just released that the emails between Trump and attorney John Eastman show efforts to submit false claims in federal court for the purpose of delaying the counting of the electoral vote on January 6, 2021. The judge ordered the release of additional emails between Trump and Eastman to the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. He said the emails cannot be withheld because they include evidence of potential crimes. The judge ordered Eastman to give the documents to the committee by the afternoon of October 28th. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
Elon Musk on Wednesday said he's excited about taking over Twitter, expressing enthusiasm, even though he's spent months trying to break free of the $44 billion buyout contract. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Thursday, October 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afoy in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russia's president declares martial law in parts of occupied Ukraine, drawing sharp rebuke from Washington.
No matter what the Kremlin says or does, no matter what they try to enact via decree, via paper or otherwise, Crimea, Donetsk, Kherson, Hunt, and Zaporizhia are Ukrainian sovereign territory.
The UN condemns Iran's violent suppression of anti-government protests.
UN human rights spokeswoman Ravina Shandasani says as many as 23 children reportedly have been killed and many injured by security forces who used live ammunition.
An El Paso bomb explosion in Myanmar's biggest prison triggers firefight, killing at least 8 people. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. President Vladimir Putin introduced martial law on Wednesday in four Ukraine region. He says Russia has annexed. These are some residents of the occupied city of Kherson left by boat following warnings of a looming assault. Luisa Knox of Reuters has more.
Lining up to leave Kherson. Residents of the now Russian-held city waited for their turn on Wednesday to evacuate after Moscow warned of a looming assault. Images of residents holding bags and pets preparing to flee the city were broadcast by Russian media, which portrayed the exodus as an attempt to clear the city of civilians before it becomes a combat zone. Meanwhile, Russia's President Vladimir Putin was introducing martial law in four Ukrainian regions, including Kherson, that he says are now part of Russia.
Donetsk People's Republic, Luhansk People's Republic, and Kherson and Zaporizhia regions had a martial law regime in force before they were incorporated into Russia. Now we need to formalize this regime within the framework of Russian legislation. Therefore, I have signed a decree introducing martial law into these four entities of the Russian Federation.
Beyond much tighter military-led security on the ground, it was unclear what the immediate impact of that would be for places like Kherson, the biggest population center Moscow has seized since invading Ukraine. Putin also issued a decree restricting movement in and out of eight regions adjoining Ukraine. Kyiv has accused Russia of laying on a propaganda show in Kherson and described Putin's declaration of martial law as the pseudo-legalization of looting of Ukrainians' property. Russian-installed authorities in occupied Kherson said they plan to evacuate up to 60,000 over the next 6 days. Ukraine is pursuing major counter-offensives in the east and south of the country. Russian forces in the Kherson region have been driven back by up to 20 miles in the last few weeks. Videos shared on social media have shown Ukrainian forces raising flags over retaken towns in the region. Reuters was not able to verify the dates of when the videos were filmed. Speaking to Russian state TV, the new commander of Russian forces in Ukraine described the situation there as difficult.
That's Luisa Knox of Reuters. The United States said it was no surprise Russia was resorting to, quote, desperate tactics, unquote, after Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday declared martial law in four partially occupied regions of Ukraine that Russia claims as its own. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel.
Russia is not wanted in these regions, and the people of Ukraine are rejecting Russia's illegal invasion and seizure by force of what is Ukrainian territory. No matter what the Kremlin says or does, no matter what they try to enact via decree, via paper or otherwise, Crimea, Donetsk, Kherson, Hunt, and Zaporizhia are Ukrainian sovereign territory. And any claim that Russia makes over these territories is illegitimate. They have no legal claim whatsoever. There is no jurisdiction that they have over those territories. This is Ukraine's land, and Russia has blatantly violated Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity, as well as violating the UN Charter with their illegal acts.
That's State Department spokesperson, Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel. Americans will vote in midterm elections on November 8 in key races that will determine which party, Republican or Democrat, will control the House of Representatives and the Senate. Analysts and party officials are framing the elections as pivotal for U.S. policy and politics for the next few years. With the country deeply divided along red and blue states, control of the legislature is vital for pushing ahead the agendas of both parties and could impact the policies of President Joe Biden for the next 2 years. For more, I spoke with VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Jepson.
Conventional wisdom here in the United States is that if the one party is in the White House, and in particular, if they hold both the White House and both chambers of Congress, then they're almost certain to lose control of those chambers in the midterm elections in between those two big presidential election years. You know, right now, there are some very encouraging signs for Democrats, the party in power, that they could be holding on to both chambers. Signs look good in terms of some of the key Senate races around the country. And there are some encouraging signs for Democrats in some key House congressional races. But of course, the conventional wisdom is rooted in fact. Americans do like to keep a balance of power between the parties. And given that President Joe Biden, a Democrat, will be continuing in the White House for another 2 years, you may see Americans want to balance that out by giving Republicans control of the Congress.
What are the issues at stake?
Well, you know, we are coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic here in this country. There are still deep-rooted concerns about the health of the American economy. A lot of average Americans are very concerned about rising cost of living. Inflation is a big concern here. We also have some more social cultural issues like abortion, which certainly came more to the forefront of debate since this past summer when the Supreme Court overturned the federal right to an abortion and sent that issue back to the states. If Republicans win control of Congress, you're almost certainly going to see a federal ban on abortions. And that concerns many independent voters, many female voters, who these past few months we've been seeing registering to vote in record numbers. So it'll be really interesting to see whether the economics comes into play more than the social issues. That's always an interesting thing to see voters here in the United States sort out for themselves.
That's VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Jepson speaking with me from Capitol Hill. British Prime Minister Liz Truss's office said former Transport Minister Grant Shapps had been appointed Interior Minister, replacing Suella Braverman, who resigned early on Wednesday. Braverman quit as Interior Minister, saying she had to go after she breached government rules, but that she had concerns over the direction of Prime Minister Liz Truss's government. Pressure continues to mount against Truss, but she tells lawmakers she is not, quote, a quitter, unquote. Associated Press correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
In the first Prime Minister's questions since new Chancellor Jeremy Hunt performed U-turns on almost all of the tax cuts announced 3 weeks ago, Truss had fiery exchanges with opposition leader Keir Starmer, who listed the full range of policy terms.
Her supposed best friend, the former Chancellor, he's gone as well. They're all gone. So why is she still here? Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, I am a fighter and not a quitter.
Truss has apologised to Parliament and admitted she's made mistakes so far during her short tenure as Britain's head of government. Charles de la Desma, London.
UN human rights chiefs have condemned Iran's violent suppression of anti-government protests as a violation of international law and call on Iranian officials to end their deadly crackdown against peaceful demonstrators. Lisa Schneider reports for VOA from Geneva.
A month has passed since the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini sparked nationwide protests against the Iranian government. Amini was arrested by the so-called morality police for improper wearing of the hijab and died 3 days later on September 16th while in police custody. UN human rights officials say they are alarmed by the unabated violent response by security forces against protesters. They say reports of arbitrary arrests and the killing and detention of children are deeply worrying. UN human rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says as many as 23 children reportedly have been killed and many injured by security forces who used live ammunition, metal pellets, and fatal beatings. She says schools also have been raided and children arrested by security forces.
Under the human rights treaties accepted by Iran, the Islamic Republic has an obligation to protect children's right to life under any circumstances and to respect and protect their rights to freedom of expression and peaceful protest. Along with the mass arrests of protesters, our office has also received reports of the arrests of at least 90 members of civil society, including human rights defenders, lawyers, artists, and journalists.
The UN Human Rights Office says the continued unnecessary and disproportionate use of force against protesters must stop. It also is calling for the immediate release of all those arbitrarily detained. Media reports say Iran's Supreme Leader Ali Hosseini Khamenei has blamed the United States and Israel for the unrest, accusing the countries of trying to stop Iran's progress. Shamdasani says her office is very concerned about the case of Elnaz Rebaki, a female Iranian climber who competed in Seoul, South Korea, without a hijab. She has since returned to Tehran, and it is not clear whether she will face repercussions. Shamdasani says her office is keeping abreast of the situation.
Concerns are being raised with the authorities as well. What we have to stress is that women should never be prosecuted for what they wear. They should never be subjected to violations such as arbitrary detention or any kind of violence with regards to what they wear. We will be following this case very closely.
Shamdasani says her office has expressed its many concerns about the protests directly to Iranian authorities. In turn, she says the Iranians have shared documents with UN officials, including investigation reports into Mahsa Amini's death. The government has said Amini died of a heart attack and was not mistreated. Her family said she had no history of heart trouble and that her body bore bruises and other signs of beating. Shamdasani says that meanwhile, the violence in Iran continues unabated. She says her office continues to receive reports of crackdowns, raids, arbitrary arrests, and killings. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, Myanmar state media and a witness said bombs inside Paso's exploded at the country's biggest jail on Wednesday. The explosion prompted soldiers to return fire in a confrontation in which at least 8 people were killed. An armed anti-hunter group claimed responsibility for the attack in Insane Prison in a statement posted on social media, saying it was, quote, in retaliation against hunter chief Ming Aung Myang. State-owned MRTV said the explosions were caused by, quote, mines inside parcels, unquote, that killed 3 prison officials and 5 visitors and wounded 18 people. A wounded witness said gunfire also broke out after the bombs exploded at the parcel counter. Myanmar had been in chaos since the military overthrew an elected government led by Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi's party and launched a brutal crackdown on dissent. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Across Pakistan this summer, flooding has displaced close to 8 million people and affected 33 million, including hundreds of thousands of pregnant women. VOA Urdu Service reporter Sidra Dar visited a medical camp in southern Pakistan province where pregnant women from some of the worst hit areas in the country come to seek help. Sira Zaman narrates.
Summer's devastating rains may have ended, but for many pregnant women displaced by the unprecedented natural disaster, there's no end in sight to suffering. Among them is Savera Ali. 8 months pregnant, she's taking refuge in a makeshift tent far from home. She can barely feed her 4 children. Taking care of herself and the baby she's carrying is almost impossible.
My home is destroyed. Where should I go? There is no hospital where I can deliver my baby. Tell me, what can I do? We are begging to get some food.
According to a United Nations report, nearly 650,000 pregnant women live in Pakistan's flood-affected areas. The World Health Organization says around 2,000 women are giving birth in unsafe conditions every day. At this crowded medical camp in Sindh province, near one of the worst-hit areas of Pakistan, Dr. Fayaz Umrani worries that the lack of basic facilities for pregnant women could cause a crisis.
I don't know what cases.
The places that are hard to reach
How will women there deliver babies? How many newborns can face complications? How many mothers suffering postpartum hemorrhaging or post-delivery problems will be able to get to a hospital? It's a horrifying picture.
20-year-old Sajda Bibi is pregnant for the first time. She traveled for an hour to get to this camp.
I came with 4 or 5 other women. My relative in this village told us about the health camp, so I came here. My body hurts. My legs ache badly. I'll go if my husband is able to take me to a hospital. Otherwise, the midwife from the village will come to deliver the baby.
Adding to the discomfort of pregnant women like Saveda Khatun are skin diseases, spreading from stagnant water and unsanitary conditions.
My house is flooded. My husband and children are sick, and my foot is in this shape. Where can we go? We just sit at home.
Doctors must exercise caution when treating such infections in pregnant women, as many common medicines are not safe for them. For Sidra Dar in Sindh, Pakistan, Sara Zaman, VOA News.
Thank you, Sarah. Experts say record-breaking floods in Australia are allowing mosquitoes to thrive, increasing the risk of spreading diseases like Japanese encephalitis. Communities across 3 states have in recent days been hit by flooding, and more torrential rain is forecast this week. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Where there's flood water, there's often mosquitoes. Parts of eastern Australia have been repeatedly flooded in the past 2 years. Mosquitoes need stagnant water. Immature insects emerge from eggs and develop underwater until they become pupae and then adults. Females require blood before laying eggs and can inject saliva and viruses into humans when they bite. Mosquito-borne diseases are a perennial problem in Australia, where thousands of people are infected with the Ross River virus each year. In 2021, Japanese encephalitis gained a significant foothold in Australia for the first time. More than 40 people were infected with the virus and 7 people died, according to government data. The virus moves between mosquitoes and water birds. Pigs too can also harbour the virus. The illness it causes can be mild, but in some cases, patients can suffer seizures. Experts have said that fewer than 1% of people infected will develop a severe brain condition called encephalitis, which can be fatal. Associate Professor Cameron Webb from the New South Wales Health Department told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that recent flooding increases the risk of Japanese encephalitis infection.
There's hundreds of different types of mosquitoes in Australia, but there's one mosquito in particular that we're concerned about when it comes to Japanese encephalitis virus. It's a mosquito that thrives in freshwater environments, the type of environments that have been created by excessive rainfall and flooding across much of the country.
Two naturally occurring climatic phenomena, La Niña and the Indian Ocean Dipole, are fueling the flooding. Experts have said their impact is being intensified by climate change. Australian troops and residents have been racing to build a 2 kilometres long levee to stop floodwaters from inundating the town of Echuca, north of Melbourne. Parts of eastern Australia have had their worst flooding in decades. With heavy rain in the forecast later this week, regions from Queensland to Tasmania in eastern Australia are once again on flood watch. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is Science in a Minute.
We've never seen anything like this before. That's what a team of scientists led by the Harvard and Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics say after observing the activity of a black hole 665 million light years away. In October 2018, they noticed a small star drifting close to it and then was ripped apart by the black hole's incredibly powerful gravity. In June 2021, the scientists noticed that the black hole was again lighting up the skies. Since the black hole hadn't gobbled up anything new, what they say they saw was it discharging previously ingested material, like the shredded star. The team says in a press release that material spewing out of it is traveling at half the speed of light. They also say they're not sure why this discharge took so long to occur. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including the Biden administration said it will continue to vigorously enforce sanctions against Iran after Russia dropped Iranian-made drones over Ukraine's capital in a series of deadly attacks over the weekend. We'll examine this and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. What is the future of the British monarchy overseas now that King Charles III is taking the reins from his more popular mother? Charles is facing a growing degree of anti-royal sentiment, not only from several Caribbean countries, which experienced colonialism and slavery, but also from countries like Australia and New Zealand. The future of the British monarchy overseas. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs and counter Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinedofa in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States hosted the first ever U.S. Pacific Islands Country Summit to build on the commitment to the people of the Pacific. The Pacific Islands and the United States have long-standing trade and diplomatic relationships. In addition to protecting the security of the region, the United States is also committed to combating the dangers of climate change. At the summit, President Joe Biden stressed the importance of strengthening these partnerships.
We're seeing the consequences of climate change around the world very vividly, including in the United States right now. And I know your nations feel it acutely.
However, preparing for climate change is a complex challenge, noted Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Building resilience is about more than equipping communities to adapt to the effects of climate crisis, which for many of you, is an existential threat. It's also about preparing communities to weather a wide range of interrelated shocks that we know have caused cascading effects.
To that end, President Biden has announced $810 million in expanded programs to improve the lives of Pacific Islanders. These investments include preparing for climate impacts on health and food security and building early warning capacity to predict, prepare for, and respond to climate hazards. Secretary Blinken also discussed plans to strengthen marine livelihoods by supporting fisheries, aquaculture, and tourism as part of the Resilient Blue Economies program. The blue economy refers to the sustainable use of ocean resources for economic growth, improved livelihoods, and jobs while preserving the health of ocean ecosystems. The United States also joined Australia, Japan, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom in the first Partners of the Blue Pacific Ministerial. Together, these countries met with members of the Pacific Islands Forum to discuss how to efficiently develop and bolster the Pacific Islands government and economies in line with PIF's 2050 strategy for the Blue Pacific continent. The United States is committed to deepening the relationship with the Pacific Island countries and helping them prepare for future climate hazards that threaten the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.